Okay, I think we're ready to reconvene. Are we going to have our rapporteur come forward and give us a little bit of, in 10 minutes? Okay, well, what we'll do in the meantime is we'll try to address some of the questions that have come forward during the first session, and then we'll come back and hear the reports from your good work in the last several minutes. We received written copies of most of the questions that came forward. We had a chance to put our heads together, and they kind of fell out into a few key areas. One of them that's sort of overarching was the question of drug resistance more generically. And people ask questions about, we know we're focusing on HIV, TB, and malaria, but what about other important infectious diseases internationally, enteric pathogens, other bacteria, and so forth? Are we really on top of drug resistance across the board? And I think the answer to that is absolutely not. We know these problems are emerging in every domain, and the same problems and the same solutions that apply to the three that are the focus here are similar for these other infectious diseases. First of all, surveillance, which requires laboratory diagnostics and the ability to get samples and do the testing. And then the second step is, of course, to understand the patterns of resistance and to broaden the pipeline to deal with it. The main difference between those enteric bacteria or the Staph aureus bacteria internationally is that there are also problems here. And so there may be more of an incentive or a little bit easier time to nudge the marketplace to address them because the requirements for helping people in the developed world are obvious to the market and the incentives are obvious to the market. So we need to try to create that same understanding of the commonality across the board for all of the infections. There were a number of questions that really dealt with the provider level or the community level intervention, issues around traditional healers and their role, best practices for the clinicians or the health aides that are really on the tip of the spear for providing these drugs. And I'd like to hear from Maria and maybe a little bit about what we've learned about best practices in terms of how drugs are actually used that might help us buy some time with these drug resistance problems.
I can answer it two ways. I'd like to touch for a second on the traditional healers. I do believe they have an absolutely critical role in the community. And we cannot pretend, one, that they don't exist, and two, that they're not very thoughtful and very helpful. A lot of our current drugs, of course, come from some of these very, very ancient remedies. And so I personally, and I think in general, we have deep respect for the healers. We also have to remember that they're usually the first line of defense. They are usually where people go before they go to a doctor or a nurse. So, yes, the answer to the question is absolutely positively. If we don't get the credibility of any new regimen or any drugs with the healers themselves, I think we've lost the battle. So I don't want to minimize that. That's why I took time on that. With respect to on the ground, tuberculosis has for many, many years developed what is called directly observed treatment, short course. Short course is 6 months, by the way, in case you're wondering. And there is a process by which people receive their drugs, and the good news is that it works. And so continuing to ensure that the treatment is available and is adopted in the field is very important. The problem is 6 months to leave your children or to leave your work in order to go take your medicine is just simply something that is completely impractical. So we're asking people to do something that we wouldn't do ourselves. Raise your hands, all of you who have never stopped an antibiotic treatment before the 14 days. So,
can I add to that?
Yeah, there are some experiences with traditional healers, particular or traditional midwives that are positive in terms of proving hygienic practice or the cutting point of then referring patients to another service when there is. You know, that they cannot be dealt with anymore. So, but I don't think it has been used as much for many of the other treatments. In terms of adherence and then really working with patients, I think what we have seen in the HIV area is really if you invest a lot in really good patient education in the beginning, and a lot of that can be done by peers, others that are already taking the medicines, that pays off in the long run. And then you can actually, I mean, we have in rural Malawi we have peers then distributing the drugs and then checking in with them, and then you can actually simplify quite a lot. But there is a limit. But as patient education with and using peers is really can pay off. And I think that this kind of a it's been different from HIV, where the treatment of HIV can really so much out of a push from activists and saying we have a right to treatment. And patients can take treatment very well, even if they don't if they're not directly observed, as long as they have all the information that they need.
Thank you. There are a set of questions that really sort of look at the systems, either the distribution system for the drugs or the delivery system of those drugs. And one specific question here, what are the creative ways that we can work with private drug sellers who are providing drugs in inappropriate doses or who don't counsel on compliance with the full regimen, et cetera, for a variety of diseases? They are contributing to resistance challenges. And what can we really do about engaging these very important components of the distribution system in ways that actually help rather than harm the process? Any comments on that?
Yeah.
As a former drug distributor?
I was never involved in distribution. One of the things that impresses me every time I go to places in Africa is the importance of the little drugstore, the over-the-counter drugstore. If you go to the clinics in the town, the government clinics, there is no medicines, but if you go to the drugstore, they have everything. In the case, we really should separate out TB treatment from HIV treatment, from malaria treatment, because it's all very different. But malaria treatment is where people go to the drugstore and buy the medicine. And price is what determines what happens. When you talk to the person who's selling the drugs, they know what drugs work. Patients do too. But it's a question of what they can afford. So price is a very important determinant of what gets used and what gets abused. So I think later on we're going to have a discussion on the price issue, and I'd like to get to that at some point, because there is a way we can actually make this work better.
Well, let's go there now. We made the comment that a few years ago the consortium didn't work, and one of the questioners said, if it didn't work 5 years ago and we could make it happen then, is it time to try it again? And if so, how should we do it now? So let's talk about what it would really take to get the consortium together, and then we can talk about how to incentivize the pricing structure that works for the village.
Hi. Recently I went to the so-called HEVR meeting, which is a group of heads of R&D in the pharmaceutical industry, and I talked to them about the need for drugs for diseases of the developing world. And just last week, I spoke to the CEOs of the pharma industry at the Pharma Strategic Planning Retreat on diseases for the developing world. And I think there's a real interest now and understanding that somehow reputation, involvement in these kinds of issues is absolutely linked to what they can do in the commercial sector, where they can actually make money. And so there's a greater willingness and an appreciation for how to do this. Now, one of the problems is that they're looking to organizations like the Gates Foundation to pay for it. My feeling is that that's probably not, it's a non-starter, it's not sustainable in the long run. So we have to have a better understanding of the levers and the partnerships that we need to establish. But this is a process that I think is ripe for revisiting, and I'm very much engaged in it, and I hope any of you from industry will bear with me and hopefully plan for a better future in this area.
So can you talk a little bit about tiered pricing and how that might help?
Right. So one of the interesting things about malaria, we said we're going to separate HIV, TB, and malaria treatment. In malaria treatment, everybody knows the right drug to use is a drug that contains artemisinin in a combination treatment, so-called ACT. Yes, artemisinin combination therapy. And interestingly enough, the pharma companies understand this, and so they have a public sector price of around a dollar for ACTs. And at the dollar price for malaria, in a broad study that we recently commissioned, there's about almost a 70% share of ACTs in the public sector. So at the price that's affordable, people know what to do, and they achieve, you know, relatively good compliance with the appropriate regimen. In the private sector, the price is anywhere from $5 to $9. The market share is less than 1%. Now, sadly, in malaria, almost 80% of treatment is in the private sector, not the public sector. So, essentially, the people that need the medicine can't afford it where they go. Something has to change here. Pharma industry, by the way, is not making any money. They have less than 1% share at $5 price, and they have a 70% share at a $1 price. I mean, do the math. Which is going to make you more money? Even if, you know, even if the margin is small, the fact is that you're going to make more money at the more affordable price. We have talked to several of the companies about this, and they are now lowering their price to that $1 price point. But more broadly, there's this issue of what pharma does with pricing for medicines. I really believe that in countries where they can't possibly make profit, by the way, in the poorest 60 nations of the world, the pharma industry makes less than 1% of all their profits in those 60 nations. So they're not making any profit anyway. It makes no sense to deprive people of medicines in these areas when they're not going to make profit by trying to catch the one or two people in Rwanda that can afford to pay for the medicine. So the idea is, if they would just come out and say, for these 60 nations, not-for-profit pricing. But for these 60 nations, absolutely, we're going to charge what we can afford, what we can. And for the ones in between, we're going to have some sort of sliding scale on a GDP per capita basis. That would make sense to me, and I think that would probably relieve some of the pressure on them in that middle sector where there is a very strong desire to go to compulsory licensing.
And let me just follow up with a very specific question for MSF, that MSF has been very active at promoting generic drugs and the use of compulsory licensing. How does this square with the need for market incentives and the R&D model?
Yes, we're faced with a double dilemma. One is that in areas where you have innovation because there's still a profitable market, like an HIV, what comes out then is too expensive. And what we have seen is that it's really only when there is really generic competition that the prices come down sufficiently and that you have to have sufficient price discounts granted by the industry. On the other hand, you don't have any innovation in the neglected diseases because there's no profitable market. And except the Gates Foundation steps in and puts some money on it, the industry is never going to, I think, really invest in that area. So I think we really have a failure of the system at a macro level. And I think as long as we pay for the cost of research and development with a high drug price, we will not solve the problem for poor countries. And I think it's very important to look at the different proposals that are out there today. Like Josef Stiglitz has a proposal, put a price fund. So you create an incentive for companies to do R&D, and then they're paid off, but then the product is a generic from day one. And I think this is very exciting times that this sort of stuff is discussed, and there's an intergovernmental working group has been created at the WHO. I mean, last time this happened was for the tobacco convention. This is real major discussions, and I think we all need to reflect how to have a better system.
I'd like to say a couple of things about tuberculosis because we've commissioned some studies on this. So the cost of tuberculosis treatment of the 6 months I was telling you about for regular treatment is about $20 for 6 months. That's not a lot of money. The problem is that in order for you to deliver the drugs, we have this very complicated system by which that I described before. That's $12 billion.
So how do we shift? I mean, the cost is there, and we're absorbing those costs. So we did an analysis, and we asked people in the field, what is it that you would like to have? And would a shorter time of treatment be better for you? And of course it is, because then that allows the health provider to be treating more people. They're not as concerned about a price increase. That I found interesting. But they were willing to pay twice or three times as much. But remember, it's $20 that we're talking about. So they're willing to pay up to $60 as long as the treatment is as good as what exists now. So a shorter treatment for more money, but that reduces and releases some of the healthcare costs, is a balance that they're willing to take up. The problem is, so what do we think the market is? The market is $315 million for first-line treatment. That's not a lot of money for pharma, but it may be some interesting market for a smaller group of company. That's in combination. That's for the total cost of drugs. The cost of multi-drug-resistant drugs, on the other hand, is very different. New York City, in the 1990s, spent $1 billion to treat the cases of drug-resistant drugs. So, again, the landscape is different, and we have to sort out which population we're going after.
Well, I've just been told that we're ready to hear about gems and themes, so we'll stop this discussion right now. I really thank the panel. I don't know how you're taking all this in, but just sitting here and kind of being in awe of the power of the individuals who are sitting here, I can't help but feel a little bit hopeful, because the conversation, the dialogue, is really talking about the kind of macro solutions that we need to solve these problems. It's not going to be easy, and there's a long way to go, but at least we're having the right conversation. So thank you for that. Are we ready to go with gems and themes?
Yep.
It's all yours, Tom.
So the room came up with some great ideas. These were some of the cross-cutting themes that were generated by the room. First of all, the need to create a coalition that would dramatically increase the sense of urgency around issues related to drug resistance, and the need to have a multi-pronged education campaign with tailored messages to providers, consumers, patients, retailers, and pharmacists. So in terms of marketing and public awareness, it's definitely not going to be a one-size-fits-all. A lot of support for this idea of trying to develop incentives for the private sector to develop new drugs and to accelerate that process. Concern about issues related to quality assurance as well, and the negative impact that substandard drugs are having on the emergence of drug resistance. In terms of some of the specific proposals that you made in the GEMS category, the need to strengthen surveillance systems for drug resistance, and whether that's a role for CDC or some other organization. Also the need to develop multi-sector partnerships for compliance with medicines, beginning all the way at the school age level. And then a really interesting model that BRAC, which is here at CGI, has developed, which is to actually provide incentives for the individual patients who engage in the right levels of compliance and complete these full courses of treatments. And then partnering with the private sector to improve the supply chain so that stockouts don't result in the inappropriate use of drugs, which can also increase drug resistance. Some of you suggested adding neglected diseases to the Orphan Drug Act, involving traditional healers, as the panel has discussed, fully funding the subsidy for artemisinin and combination therapy that Tachi talked about. One interesting angle on this is, if you provide the subsidy, how do you make sure that the patients get the full benefit of that subsidy? So that's an important issue that needs to be worked out. Using IT solutions such as the cell phone to provide community health workers information about drug treatment. And finally, to strengthen the link and the integration between HIV and TB, given the co-occurrence, and the motto for this one was, to avoid TB, wear a condom. So that's an extraordinarily large number of creative suggestions. There were many more that we got as well that we will be reviewing and trying to identify key issues for CGI 2008. So thank you very much.
So, yeah, what I'm going to do before the panel escapes is to just ask for a couple comments on these themes and gems. We'll just go right down the row, starting with Maria. You know, what do you like? What are you excited about? And what can we do about it?
Okay, so I don't know where they would wear the condom, but that's a different issue. Yeah. Regarding the FDA, these diseases usually are orphan diseases because the incidence in the United States is not very big. So we do have that advantage. So I'll take a look at some others, but those are the two that come to mind.
The issue that was brought up here on resistance surveillance, I think, is critical. I think malaria should be on there because as a global health community, we have been sitting for very long on chloroquine resistance, and we should monitor very closely what's happening with the artesamines as well. I think the point that's made here on the supply chain and make sure there are no stockouts and inappropriate use of drugs, is the right one, and it has to go very importantly also with issues of free treatment, because we've seen if people have to pay a lot, they end up just taking half of the drugs, sharing them, and that's where you get where you actually create drug resistance and start failure.
I think the suggestion to fully fund the ACT malaria subsidy is a really important one. And the question of eliminating tariffs, some of you may not know that although the medicines can be provided by the pharmaceutical companies at a very, very low price, there are tariffs put on them by the countries, and the tariffs then can double, triple, or quadruple the price. So there is a fundamental issue here that I think is raised by that point, which is somehow the countries have to be engaged in this. It can't be just all from outside. The countries have to perceive this as a problem sufficiently large that they're not going to charge taxes in order to try to get rid of the problem. And that, I think, is a major order of public will.
Go ahead. Yeah, I wanted to pick up the issue of education because I firmly believe that this is a very important issue. And there's several of these bullets that address that, including the IT solutions. So anything that we can do to form a very broad platform that is very far-reaching, I think, would be very important.
I'd like to just end with my own favorite, and that to avoid TB, wear a condom is attractive to me because it speaks to the issue of integration and remembering that sometimes the person with TB does have HIV, but the person may also have a child with malaria, live in a hut with no water, and be at risk for a number of other health problems that need to be integrated. So I'd probably say avoid TB, wear a condom, sleep under a bed net, wash your hands, and use a water vessel. At any rate, this has been a really spectacular conversation. Thank you for your hard work at the tables, and I'll excuse the panel now while we have a chance to honor our commitments that some people have made on behalf of the CGI and global health. Thank you. At this time, I would like to invite Janice Huey, the president of the Council of Bishops. Janet, are you here? Can you please come forward? I'm going to present our first certificate on behalf of the United Methodist Church, who has contributed a commitment of $1.5 million for fighting malaria with bed nets. And let me just say two words about this. As we all know, every 30 seconds a child dies of malaria, and the United Methodist Church and its partners are making a commitment to donate at least 150,000 insect-treated bed nets to help reduce the incidence of malaria in areas of the Cote d'Ivoire that are most affected by this disease. And this action will affect the lives of 600,000 people. So we thank you for your commitment. Let me hand you the certificate, and we can move over this way for...
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Let's have some applause. I'd now like to invite Jessica Beal, John Beal, and Chris Wong to the podium so that we can thank you for your commitment. Thank you, Jessica.
Yes, hi.
John?
Yes.
Very nice to meet you. I'm Julie Gerberding.
Hi.
Let me have you stand right here, and I'll just say a few words about this commitment. This is a very exciting commitment. From something called the Make the Difference Network. This is founded by Jessica and her father, and the Make the Difference Network provides nonprofits with the web tools that they need so that every single person can log into this network and become a grassroots philanthropist. So the commitment involves the MTDN making a social networking site. Small and medium-sized nonprofits can engage with millions of potential donors through these sites, and the commitment is that by the end of the two-year period of time, 15,000 nonprofits averaging $500 per month in donations will donate a total of $90 million. So let's thank you for that. Thank you. It's a terrific idea. Thank you. I think we have the... photographer here?
Yes, right here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I would like to invite Peter Lamptey and Albert Siemens to come to the podium. Peter is the president of the Institute for HIV/AIDS of Family Health International, and Albert is the chairman and CEO of the same organization. Thank you. And I'll say a few words about your commitment. Family Health International is launching a bold and innovative initiative to reclaim a generation lost by better serving children and families affected by HIV/AIDS. They're doing this on two critical fronts: rapidly expanding services to treat children and scaling up a pilot program to prevent orphaning. Through their commitment, FHI is tripling its current reach of pediatric treatment in 1 year by rapidly scaling up ARV treatment to an additional 20,000 children in more than 200 sites in at least 10 countries for a value of a commitment of somewhere around $175 to $200 million over 5 years. That's incredible. Thank you so much. Here.
This side.
Okay. Center here. With your certificate.
Thank you.
I also have two other things that I know I need to announce, but the paperwork isn't here. So, Eric Gooseby, are you still here in the room? I think Eric has left us, but I know, oh, Eric, there you are. Please just accept my acknowledgement for the Pangea commitment. I don't have the talking points here, but maybe you want to just say two words about what you're doing. Well, I'll say them for you since you don't have a microphone. The Global AIDS Foundation, the Pangea Global AIDS Foundation, is going to establish a model for integrated HIV/AIDS care, treatment, and prevention tailored specifically to the needs of small and medium enterprise employees and their dependents. So another sector heard from, and thank you very much for that, Eric. Eric and I go a long way back to the first days of HIV in San Francisco at San Francisco General Hospital, and both of us still work at that hospital. So it's wonderful to get a chance to see a friend who's been there from the beginning. I'd also like to acknowledge the Global Business Coalition on HIV/AIDS, TB, and Malaria, which is making a commitment in partnership with Coca-Cola, Beijing, Prospective Orient Movie and Television, and others to use mass media to raise HIV awareness and to reduce stigma and discrimination of people living with HIV/AIDS in China. They'll start with a weekly commercial during Fortune China, which is a popular business show that reaches an audience of about 741 million people. So that's a terrific commitment as well, using the power of the media. Kimberly, there you are. Thank you. I think that brings us to the conclusion of this session. These are tremendous commitments, a little bit awesome. Even in government, those are big dollars. So we really appreciate the not only monetary value, but the spirit of the heart that it represents from the people who are here on the podium, but also the people who stand behind these commitments and make them work on the front line. Thank you all for your contributions, and we look forward to turning some of these ideas into action. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes work session 3.